We had a meeting where we said we were going to be a consortium. I remember this, but maybe we're not. Maybe I like affinity group better. But one of the things we've been talking about as a group, affinity group, consortium, whatever you want to call us, over the past year and a half or so, is that, as Scott said at the beginning, the public health law is on the defensive, right? That we see courts and legislatures being less and less hospitable to public health law. And part of what the George Group is doing is trying to think of responses in ways that legal academics working in partnership with our friends in public health can change that tide. And part of what we wanted to do today, as Scott has done, is be a little less defensive ourselves. So we decided we were going to be up a little bit more upbeat today. But I'm going to be a little upbeat, but also a little critical at the same time. We realized that we need to develop doctrinal responses to the increasing inhospitability to public health. We want to work on law review articles, policy briefs, and amicus briefs. But we also have talked a lot about the importance of going beyond doctrinal responses and to develop or revive normative arguments in support of public health. And I think Scott's talk did a great job of talking about some of the ways we need to talk and frame arguments differently. And I want to carry on in that vein here. We didn't compare this. We didn't work together. But we've all heard the nanny state critique. It's out there everywhere. It seems to be the critique du jour right now. And besides the lovely picture, I like that E. Poppins, I like that. Besides the picture of Maya Bloomberg, Karen Harnett in Forbes wrote, "Our government was not created to interfere in our lives or restrict our freedom of choice in such a way. Americans are intelligent enough to make suitable choices without government deciding for them. As our federal, state, and local governments consider public policy decisions, let's hope that common sense can prevail." I want to suggest that we in public health have spent a lot of time, or at least we in public health law, both embracing and responding to this nanny state critique. I trace it back to Richard Epstein, and he talked about the old public health, right? And that was an argument that in the good old days, once upon a time, the good old days when cholera was common, right? In those good old days, public health stuck to infectious communicable diseases, and that was, right, its proper purview, at least in terms of legal authority. But when we now have the new public health, it is paternalistic, and public health is overstepping its boundaries, unjustly limiting liberty. I think Larry Gostin, I'm putting up here, and there's a lot of different ways, and Larry's work, of course, Larry's been writing for a while, and it's changed somewhat over time, but I'm suggesting here that Larry's response to some of Richard Epstein's, to this nanny state critique, has been to have a capacious view of the harm principle, right? We can accept the idea that paternalism may be problematic, but say that much of what we do in public health is not really paternalistic, because we need to recognize the way our behavior affects others, right? And so it's not a violation of an anti-paternalism law to enact public health. Thaler and Sunstein, Scott has already talked about, but they talk about libertarian paternalism, right? Respecting basic libertarianism, but emphasizing the fact, as Scott said, that preferences are created by external cues and norms, and that it's not really, right, a violation of libertarianism or a violation of an anti-paternalistic principle to use law to set the choice architecture, to nudge people to do the helpful choices. I put myself here as sort of shy at doing this, but a lot of other people do too, which is to say, well, the response, it's a little bit different than Thaler and Sunstein's, but to emphasize that there is a population perspective and to say, well, actually the paternalism argument is wrong because people are not individually situated. People make their choices, they face the risks that they face in populations, they influence the risks of others. And so in one sense, it's drawing heavily on both the capacious harm principle and the libertarian paternalism response. In a recent book, Sarah Conley, has defended paternalism. She's gone somewhat differently. She said, you know, paternalism and proud, what's wrong with paternalism? Nothing. Right? She goes and argues from a consequentialist viewpoint that if we can protect people, if we can prevent harm and disutility by being paternalistic, then let's do it. And that all of the risks and dangers and problems that are associated with paternalism is also associated with laws that limit people from harming others, right? Laws can overreach whether they're based on the harm principle or they're paternalistic. And then Lindsay here and Micah Berman in a recent article have said, look, we shouldn't be talking about paternalism. We should talk more about the democratic process. And I want to follow up on their invitation here to this issue. In a recent book, John Cogan had wrote, within a liberal political system, we are all subjects as well as sovereigns. And I think that that's an important point. We are not just the subjects of public health. We are not just people whose liberty is limited by public health. But we are also the sovereigns who make the laws that limit our own liberty. And so I want to talk about public health as self-governance. And suggest that much of the conversation in recent years and the paternalism debate, especially in the popular realm, has overlooked the fact that public health laws are not just laws that are done to us. They are, at least ideally, laws that we do to ourselves. That we have focused too much in recent years on the negative liberty that public health laws limit, and not enough on the positive liberty that public health law as self-governance allow us to do. The public health laws in this sense are very much the way that we as individuals come together with other individuals as citizens to make our environment one which is healthy, to assure the conditions by which we can be healthy. To think about public health law as self-governance and what that might mean, and to think about some of the downsides or problems that we in public health have had, I think it's worth talking for a second about two recent court cases, both of which deal with municipal public health laws. The first one is the one that has gotten a lot more press, of course. It's Maya Bloomberg or Nanny Bloomberg's Big Gulp ban. And recently, this past summer, a New York appellate court in New York Statewide Coalition of Hispanic Chambers of Commerce affirmed an injunction issued by a lower court against New York's Board of Health's regulations limiting the sale of large sugary sodas. What's interesting about that case is that the court really emphasized the limited authority of the City Board of Health and the arbitrary, and what it felt was the arbitrary and capricious nature of the regulation. And I think from a public health law perspective, opinion is very, very troubling for what it says about public health powers, what it says about the kind of evidence that public health law needs to achieve its goal. But I want to contrast the Big Gulp case with a lesser-known case, Cleveland versus Ohio, a case decided by an appeals court in the state of Ohio last spring, which struck down a Ohio law which would have preempted a Cleveland ban on trans fats. And what's really interesting to me about the opinion in the Cleveland case is that the court emphasizes, and this is indeed under an Ohio, you know, under Ohio law, but the court emphasizes the role of the importance of home rule under the state constitution, and that public health law is an exercise of home rule. Interestingly and importantly, the trans fat ban was enacted by the city council, whereas the Big Gulp ban was in, promulgated by the Board of Health. And the court in Ohio really emphasized that the state, by trying to preempt the ban without imposing any regulations, was limiting and undercutting the power of the city's people to protect themselves. I think this raises for me a couple of questions. And they're only questions, and the two cases, we could talk more about them at Q&A, but they're only two cases, and I know the risk of drawing too much out of two cases. But one is, are laws that are more popularly rooted more secure doctrinally? That's the legal realist in me asking it. But another way of just saying that, and I think this is the doctrinalist would say, look, we know that laws that are promulgated through administrative agencies are always going to be subject to more judicial attack, right, than statutes. Statutes are going to be struck down only if they're unconstitutional. Laws that are regulations promulgated by agencies can be struck down by a whole, you know, for lack of process, for arbitrary and capricious, a whole realm of judicial challenges that are not there by legislative enactment. But the other question I want to ask is, can we distinguish disdain for laws limiting liberty from a rejection of elitism and expertise? Or to ask that question another way, is the anti-paternalism rap that we're all hearing so much about really a rejection of paternalism? Well, Scott's great data, interesting data, would suggest no. And I want to say that maybe it's really not so much that we're all concerned all the time, or Americans are just totally obsessed with their liberty, live free or die, but maybe sometimes it's the way that public health laws not only are framed, but the way they are enacted. A sense of they are coming from bureaucracies that are not necessarily responsive to the popular will, instead of coming from the community. And I thought about this a couple of weeks ago when I was listening to a talk we had at Northeastern University. We had Mayor Menino. He's been mayor of the city for 20-odd years, and he's stepping down. The election is tomorrow for his replacement. And he came to receive an award for his public health work. And as one listens to all the things that Mayor Menino has done in Boston, it's really clear that actually he's done a lot of the same things that Mayor Bloomberg has done, but with a whole lot less controversy, right? A lot less. Now, part of it is, you know, we're Boston, we're small, we don't get as much publicity. We like to think we're the hub of the universe, but we're not. But part of it, I think, is also the difference in tone. And when Mayor Menino talks, he doesn't talk about what's good for you, and he doesn't talk about the public health powers. He talks about, I walk around to the communities and mothers are telling me they're worried about their kids aren't getting good foods. And so what can we do? And I think it's my job as mayor to help the folks in the community. I can't imitate him. I can't do the accent. I can't do it. But it's a totally different tone than what you usually hear from Mayor Bloomberg. And it's a tone in which public health law is presented as coming from the community for the community. Now, I'm not saying that's always the case. And of course, he has a lot of great public health law and public health leaders working with him. But what I want to say is he always roots it back into the community rather than into expertise, even though, of course, there's a lot of expertise relying on it. So I want to suggest that public health needs to look in the mirror. And we have to ask what our own emphasis on public health powers, the powers of public health agencies, and our own view, which I think has increased a lot in the last decade or so, of public health law as a technical tool that we can teach, that we can learn about, that we can create as a technical enterprise to be used to advance public health. Have we obscured the role of that popular sovereignty can and should play in public health law? Have we tried to make public health law an exercise for technicians rather than the way that folks in the community, that citizens get together and make assure the conditions for their own health? I know that there are challenges in this. Obviously, there are emergencies, and we first started having boards of public health to respond to emergencies. Emergencies will continue, and the Democratic and popular process is slow. There's complexity. There's a good reason for expertise these days. I want to talk about interconnection because everything I just said makes a lot, works a lot on the municipal level, but surely we know there are public health problems in our complicated, interconnected global globe that really can't be solved at the local level. There are unequal resources. We know Scott talked about regulated industries. Regulated industries have a whole lot more resources, and that gets to campaign financing. Thinking about public health law as popular sovereignty is hard to do in the era of Citizens United, but I think it's something that we should at least consider. And therefore, I will end with the fact that I have no campaign finance conflicts to mention. Thanks.